We will call the meeting to order. This is the State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, March 21st, 2012. We do have a quorum, and would someone move the minutes from the meeting from yesterday?
So moved.
Representative Leidiger moves the minutes from March 20th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. members of the audience, the legislature was in session until almost 2:30, and all of the folks who are around the table now deserve, I think, a special gold star for being up and at 'em this early in the morning. The first bill on the schedule is a bill we heard yesterday, took testimony on it yesterday, but we were still officially waiting for it to be sent to our committee, and that has now happened. And so I will move House File 1821 be recommended to pass and sent to Ways and Means. Representative Detmer.
Well, thank you, and good morning, everybody. Listen to the radio station coming in this morning from Forest Lake, and it's welcome. It's great to be back at the committee here, and we list, and also that we had some great testimony discussions yesterday. So I'd like to just finish the job here and move on to the next committee in Ways and Means.
Discussion on the bill. And since we took testimony yesterday and no discussion, I will renew the motion that House File 1821 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
The next bill on our schedule is House File 2720, Representative Banyan. Representative Banyan, do you want to go ahead and move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to that the committee recommend to pass House File 2720 and re-refer this bill to the Committee on Ways and Means.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a good history of this, but I'd also, I have an amendment for this. Thank you. You have also, and I believe it's in everyone's packet, the DE-1 amendment. This bill has already been heard by the Senate part of, and up to subdivision 4. Our goal was to make the language in the Senate, which was largely cleanup language, consistent with what the Senate file had. Mr. Shepard and I worked together for that. Subdivision 4 is a change that comes.
Representative Banyan, maybe we should get the.
Just move it?
Get you to move the bill and then.
All right.
The amendment, I mean.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I'll just go ahead and move the DE-1 amendment.
Representative Banyan moves the DE-1 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author prefers. Any further comment about the amendment?
Again, just subdivisions 1 through 3. Give us consistency with what the Senate did with its version of this bill last week. Subdivision 4 is going to be different than they have. It calls for the chart of outcomes to be produced by MMB and then brought back to the legislature for consideration and approval. Members, I ask for your support.
Discussion on the DE-1. That'll be the bill that we will discuss here as we go forward. All in favor of the DE-1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is now in the form that the author prefers. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. I don't think I can beat Representative Detmer's good morning, so I'll just proceed. This bill is a product long in the making. It sprung out of our our reconsideration of the zero-based budgeting material, Bill House File 2, that we talked about last year. There were concerns in several quarters about it, and at one point, Peter Nelson, who's here with me from the Center for the American Experiment, came to me and said, you know, we should continue to work on this and come up with some other ideas. Over time, and I'll give Peter as much credit as I would dare take for myself, I would say more, we were able to bring a group of individuals together to look at this, including Peter Hutchinson from PSG and Dane Smith from Growth and Justice, and eventually came along, Tom Hesse is here, from the Chamber of Commerce. And our discussions included folks from MMB, and I believe Ms. Kelly is here from MMB. I don't know if she wishes to speak, but she's at least present here. And we have had discussions about how this will work. I think what I'll do is I'll turn details over. Peter, I think you can, or maybe Tom wants to do that. But I'll let them present the details of this, and I'll come back and give some rationales later.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And as Representative Banyan mentioned, the guts of the bill are on the last page. And the chart of outcomes and the determination of the initial chart of outcomes are really what this legislation is all about. And it's a simple concept. We're just seeking to provide a little bit different strategy on how the state budgets and link programs and activities in the current budget system to a level outcome initially, and then later into what we call in the legislation contributing outcomes. Why that's important, I think Peter Nelson will address here in a little bit, but really what we're seeking is try to get some consensus from the legislature, from the administration, about what are the 8 to 10 core outcomes that citizens are expecting from government. Once we do that, we can figure out underneath those, and for example, educating kids might be, you know, having a sound educated workforce might be one of them. We can figure out what are the 3 to 5 contributing outcomes that will lead us to that goal. And then underneath that, performance measures. So we can start building up a more analytic approach to measuring how we're doing with respect to individual programs, individual activities of state government towards meeting the outcomes that citizens want government to achieve. That's really the goal of this legislation. And again, we thank the MMB for working with us to try to work out some of the kinks and make it administrative, having them be able to administrate it. We are still having conversations about that with them, but it's a pretty simple concept. We are trying to link individual budget items with the outcomes that they are primarily designed to address. And with that, maybe I'll turn it over to Peter Nelson.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Nelson. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Center of the American Experiment. And this bill, I mean, the whole concept of changing our budget process really comes out of the need to start taking a more intentional look at how we're spending the state's money. We all know that we've experienced some budget problems over the past few years, and we all know that we're going to be experiencing more budget problems moving forward. The demographics just are working against us right now. And when you look at the fact that, say, in 2000 we had 5 working adults per retiree, and when you look at 2030 we're looking at 3 working adults per retiree, those demographics don't look good. And we all know the data about how healthcare spending is projected to rise at about 8.5%, I think, per year, while revenues are spending at a much lower, I believe, 4% per year. Those are the projections that we've heard in the past couple of years. So we need to really start taking a harder look at how we're spending our tax dollars. And, you know, when we look at our recent budget experiences and we see how we budget, we know that we're not taking a hard look at how we're spending our money. And so, for example, our current budget process generally takes the last budget and assumes that we're spending our money on all the right things and spending our tax dollars to their highest and best purpose. We just basically assume that without really taking a look at whether we're actually getting the outcomes that we truly expect we should be getting from those tax dollars. And so, for example, in this past budget cycle, instead of taking a hard look at how we're spending our money to meet some of the budget problems that we had last year, we really just looked at the margins of the budget. And by the margins of the budget, I'm talking about programs that we might not consider as necessary, but we didn't take a hard look at the program. We just sort of tweaked the program. So, for instance, we looked at relative personal care attendants, and we just lowered the rates that we paid to relative personal care attendants, but we really didn't take a hard look at that program, and there was no system in place to look at that program. And that could be a great program that we just cut payment rates to. Or it could be a program that we should have reconsidered restructuring. But we didn't have that conversation. What we did is we just sort of took a look at the margins of the budget and we just reduced rates that we paid there. And we believe that we should have some sort of institutionalized process that really takes a hard look at how we're spending our money and forces us to ask questions on a regular basis that we right now aren't asking questions about how we're spending money, asking questions about whether programs are achieving the results that we expect them to achieve. And so that's what we want to do. We know we started this process with the Sunset Commission, and the Sunset Commission, you know, it provides the first really institutionalized tool to start taking a look at how we're spending our money. And we think that we should start thinking a little more broadly and looking at the current budget process and using the current budget process as a way to start asking questions and a way to start taking and to start a process where we're truly measuring what we're doing with our state tax dollars and using those measurements to direct money to their highest and best use as we look to the future and the fact that in the future we are going to have we're going to have tougher budget decisions moving forward.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, Mr. Nelson. I know that you spend a lot of time around here. I saw you testifying on the right to work amendment, too, so I know you spend a lot of time in committee. So I guess I'm surprised to hear you say several times that we don't talk a lot around here about how we spend our money and where our money is spent, and whether or not it's spent wisely. We spend a lot of time talking about that. But what I wanted to ask you was, on line 2.19 to 2.20, there's new language added requiring and achieving statewide outcomes, and I'm wondering if you or maybe the author could explain what a statewide outcome would look like.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Moline, for the question. As Mr. Hesse indicated, if you turn to page 4 and look at line, particularly at 4.4, you see state-level core outcomes. That is the statewide outcomes that are referred to on line 2.20.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Banyan, well, why don't you explain that a little more than the core outcomes listed on lines 4.4 to 4.7.
Okay.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Moline. I'm delighted to do so. This is going to be the function of what this initial chart will look like. The first thing you will see is a list of 8 to 10 statewide outcomes that we think are the things which we want to purchase with our state tax dollars here in the state of Minnesota. They can be items on improving the health of our population, looking out for our vulnerable populations, etc. These are top level outcomes. From there, underneath each one, you will see on lines 4, 5, and 4, 6, contributing outcomes which flesh out what those top level statewide outcomes will be. And then from there, each one of those Each one of those will have a performance measure that is attached to it. So part of the, and that process is it, how you build that is what's defined in Section 2. The initial chart of outcomes has to be established in some way, and in the DE1 that you've adopted here this morning, it imagines that to be done from MMB. I will tell you, Representative Moline, the history of this, the first place you saw this happen was in the state of Washington, and in that state, the initial chart came out of discussions within the executive branch under Governor Locke in the state of Washington, and then was brought into consultation in the legislature, and eventually bills passed that embedded that chart of outcomes within its statutes. And so that then is what gets referred back to go back to your initial question, that's what gets referred back to in 219 and 220 in terms of what the agencies will be doing.
Representative Moline.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Banyan. So then the establishment of those charts of outcome, it looks like that comes from the Commissioner of MMB, mm-hmm. the chairs of the ranking minority members of House and Ways and Means Committee, and legislative staff designated by those legislators. So that's where the outcomes are coming from. They're not coming from the citizens of Minnesota.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Moline. Yes, that is actually this bill, in the way we've amended it, envisions that to happen through the legislature, and that citizens will participate through their elected officials, and particularly looking at lines 416 and 417, that this chart will be implemented as soon as possible after enactment of a law approving the chart of outcomes.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess, is somebody from MMB planning to testify today?
Representative
yes.
Banyan?
It appears that yes. Ms. Kelly will be testifying.
The answer is yes.
I'll wait for that.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, you are spot on with your comments and the questions, and what you've just explored in your questions is really the rub of this thing. And I'm going to support this bill strongly, but I want us to be really careful as we move this one forward. We all have our partisan positions, and we advocate hard on our stuff, right? But the intention of this is that we would actually create some performance reporting infrastructure at the state, and that absolutely has to be as nonpartisan as it can get. And we can all bark about the fiscal note process, and we like some and we don't like some, and we try and fine-tune it and improve it. But we do rely on it, and we more or less trust it. The process is sound, and without it, we don't really have much of a chance on our bills. So I just want to urge us to be really careful and recognize this is the right starting point, and I think Representative Banyan is coming at this with absolutely the right degree of caution, because we can't blow it, because if we do and this turns into a partisan, contest, it'll melt down. It'll never work. And I just want people to think about this a little bit in terms of how we measure things. And we've had a ton of discussion in this committee over the last 3 years. But right now in state government, we largely measure inputs and transaction volumes and throughputs. And yes, we make a ton of decisions about how to spend our money and our priorities, but the information we look at is largely kind of internal volume data as compared to anything that really measures our performance. And so if you want to look at whether you're performing well, you got to kind of move up the chain. And it's pretty easy to go to the next step, which is to measure your operational performance and your processes, how fast do you do things. Are you seeing so many people per day? These other kinds of things that give you some indication of performance. But where it gets trickier is when you try and go up one level further and say, all right, are we really accomplishing the outcomes that we want to accomplish within a program or a division of an agency? And then it gets even trickier when you step up to where where this bill starts to point us, and that is an overall chart of outcomes that attempts and presumes to be able to express kind of the highest definition of our collective values as a state. And that's exactly where Representative Molina was going, I think, is, oh my gosh, this is what the political process does, right? I mean, we figure this out every 2 years in November. What are the outcomes that our citizens want? And are we going to have some kind of mechanical process that the department does that supersedes what the electoral process and the vigorous debate that we have typically provides for us? And so great questions. I think we should continue to have the discussion. And I think the bill at least gets us along the way in the internal tracking and reporting mechanisms of how do you start looking at what you're spending money on in the state budget as compared to through the vertical siloed lens of fiscal committees and subsets of fiscal committees. But let's really look across that and say, what are we trying to accomplish with all of these programs, and how many interacting moving parts do we have all targeting some outcome that's where the operations and activities are spread over five agencies, and look at things a little bit differently. So sorry to give such a long preamble, but I've worked on this with Representative Banyan and Peter Hutchinson and others as well. I really support this. We got to be careful. We can't get ahead of ourselves and have it be a partisan deal if it's ever to have any lasting value. So we're better off going slow, and I think this is the right slow first step. And maybe I'll just ask a question for any of the testifiers. So this question of what's the intersection of politics and the political process and this chart of outcomes, how do those interact and stay aligned and in tune enough that we have confidence in them?
Mr. Hesse, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey and committee, I think the way that this works moving forward is right now the chart of outcomes needs to be approved by the legislature, and the legislature is elected by the people. So that, in my opinion, is how we connect to the people and get the people's position on what they expect from government. And so long as we have the legislature playing a role in defining what these outcomes are, and so long as we do also have an executive role involved in this too, because the executive, of course, is represents the people as well. But the legislature, so long as they're tied to this, I think we're on target. And I appreciate your comments regarding the fact that this is trying to take a look at whether we're actually getting results for what we're spending our money on, and that's what's missing from the conversation. Because Representative Molina is correct, we obviously have long and hard discussions about what are we spending our money on, but they're not informed with data and with the metrics that we really should have to start making some smart decisions.
Representative Moline asked if someone from MMB was available to testify. Could we have MMB at the table? Good morning, Ms. Kelly. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. And I appreciate Representative Downey's caution with this bill. There are not many states that are doing outcome-based budgeting, and the reason is that it's very challenging. Not that it can't be done, but it's very challenging to do it correctly. Washington State has been more successful than any other state in implementing this. It was a process that involved a one-year go-around-the-state bottom-ups approach in terms of developing outcomes, and that then was embraced by both the legislature and the administration. The state of Michigan has tried to do this. It was an effort that was driven by the legislature, and the legislature reconfigured the budget once the governor delivered the budget to the legislature, aligned their committee structure with those outcomes. They did that for just a couple of years, and it has not been maintained. The state of Virginia is doing something akin to this, but not quite the same. And so it is something that requires a thoughtful approach and a commitment, I think, to be successful by both the administration and the legislature.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and members, I may be the only one who paid any attention to this, but the U.S. PIRG project published a report, and I know I sent it to Commissioner Showalter, Commissioner Kronk, and various other people, which was a rating of the essentially the transparency of states and their information systems. And Minnesota got like a C, or C plus, or something like that. It was way down on states in terms of transparency. And I'll send it to all the members of the committee, too. I'm just, we may have all gotten it. We may have all gotten it. I know I have it. I was kind of looking for the link somewhere. Any thoughts about that, about the problems? The response I got from Commissioner Showalter wasn't, it said, oh, well, they're unreliable because we don't understand how they do their criteria. In 1 year, we went from a C to a C plus or something like that. Well, in the time, in the space of things, that doesn't seem like a very big change. It seems pretty bad for both. And is this anything that anyone is paying attention to?
Is that a question for Ms.
Yes.
Kelly? Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm not familiar with that evaluation or grade. I would anticipate that it's there's a movement across states in terms of transparency on via the web for spending at a very detailed level. And we have tried to do that in Minnesota. I think it's called TAP on the MMB's website. We, with the new accounting system coming up, we have delayed continuation of that until we have reliable, consistent reporting out of that system that we can then build a web access to get reporting out of the accounting system. But I would guess, without having read it, that that is what the evaluation across states is about.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, unlike some of your bills, I really like this one. But but it's totally dependent. I hate to join with Downey too often. It kills my far-left reputation, which I try to run on. But, you know, it's clearly problematic unless we have very good transparency, which is reporting and all that stuff. And I will send this to everyone. You know, I know that Commissioner Showalter got it and paid attention to it because he answered me. So, you know, that's a source if I can't find it. But it was a national report, and there were some reports. You know, the thing I was interested in was just how badly Minnesota was rated, when we kind of think we can take pride in such things as openness in government.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, in your looking at these other states that have put these processes in place, and you mentioned Michigan kind of not really, it's not going anyplace. And you're looking at Washington State, is there one key element that you see lacking in Michigan that is in Washington State in making this happen?
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative, perhaps others could help answer that question as well. I think one of the big differences in Washington State is just that it's administration-led, but it's also been supported by the legislature.
Mr. Hesse?
Mr. Chair and members, when we worked on this legislation, we worked with, as has been mentioned, Peter Hutchinson and folks from Public Strategies Group. Their view, and they helped Michigan, they've helped Washington State, Iowa, and others implement some of these initiatives. Their thought is the reason why it may have gone away after a couple of years' time in Michigan and others is they didn't institutionalize anything in their budgeting systems, and that's what the chart of outcomes is all about. It's institutionalizing something into your budgeting system, so it's there, and you can track it, and it's kind of a permanent fixture. That was absent in those other states, and we hope that we can fix that problem here.
Thank you.
Seeing that no one else wishes to be heard relative to this, any final comments, Representative Banyan and Representative Downey, I'm sorry.
Oh, if I could, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to chime in twice here, but again, I'll just restate my interest that this has got to be a nonpartisan, totally bipartisan thing if we are able, because we have the votes, to push this through and force the executive branch to do something. This thing is destined for failure, and so I this is one of those things that should be a committee bill if we can, and I don't want to stop the process from moving forward here. I think we should move it out of this committee and continue the process. My own personal commitment to everybody on the other side of the aisle is to make sure that this thing can advance in that fashion, or it's going to go nowhere. And I had the opportunity to sit in on the pay-for-performance bonds steering committee meeting and started to see the work that the nonprofits Commissioner Showalter's staff are doing to begin in some program areas to actually measure the success of what we're doing. And I'm telling you, this stuff is really powerful and extremely helpful for us as legislators. And if we get it right, this will serve us well, literally for decades. So anyway, I support the bill and just want to do so in that spirit.
Representative Kahn, and then members, we need to move on. We've got a full agenda here.
Just a final comment. I think there are some thoughts that this, any time we've tried to do performance measurement, I'm sorry Representative Winkler isn't here because he had a citizen's portal in some bill that we did, it's fallen down because of lack of interest of the legislature. The legislature has not pushed it, the legislature has not demanded it or paid any attention to it. And hopefully this is a change. And I would not, I would not make this a committee bill, because I think Representative Banyan should get some credit for doing something at least this session. Good.
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. If I could just add, the real challenge in pulling this off would be on the part of agencies. And while we can... I think we have a fiscal note that suggests there would be MMB staff effort and time in aligning our systems to do this. The real work is going to be on the part of agencies, and we have been challenged to do performance measuring in our budget because of the capacity at the agency level to do that. And so if this bill were to move forward and were adopted, it may not look exactly like you want to see it right away. I think the first budget, given the amendment, the first budget that would be reflected in this way is the 16-17 biennial budget.
That's correct. Representative Banyan, do you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you, and thank you to the great discussion today. I renew my motion that House File 2720 be passed and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
As amended?
As amended. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Banyan. Representative Ward.
I'll send it to Maury and tell him to send it.
Welcome, Representative Ward, and I will move House File 157, and our intent is to lay this over for possible inclusion. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. It's nice to be with you again. We've been apart for so long. After spending a lot of time together, I'm really impressed that you even showered this morning, all of you, and I really appreciate that as well. And it's nice to be back together again. Mr. Chair, I just before we start on this bill, it's always nice when we are honored with veterans around us, and I know we all feel that way. So I just want to start by saying thank you for your service to all the veterans that are here today. and it truly is an honor for us to be surrounded by you. So just wanted to start with that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward, we all feel the same way.
I know, that's why I said that. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm with former Senator Don Samuelson and City Councilor Lucy Nesham, who are going to make some comments about House File 157. Members, and in your packets, you have a lot of information about the Brainerd Veterans Nursing Home, a bill that I've sponsored for a number of years. And, you know, members, this is House File 157. Obviously, I introduced it in January of last year. And members, in particular, I want you to pay attention in your packets to the survey that was taken by the Minnesota Veterans Department of Affairs, done in 2009. And in that survey, Mr. Chair, it was taken as a statistical data for where you don't have that in your packets.
Representative Ward, it was just noticed that somehow they didn't get in. We're going to go get the retrieve those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when you do get the packets, members, besides a lot of good information about you know, the economic impact of a veterans nursing home in our area, survey that was done by the Minnesota Veterans Department of Affairs indicates that the next nursing home, and they looked at a lot of different data. They looked at all kinds of statistical information, but they came up with the result that the next federal veterans nursing home in the state of Minnesota should be placed in Little Falls, Brainerd, Crosby area. They are 1, 2, and 3 on the list of priorities for all the communities that want to have a veterans nursing home. Little Falls, 1, Brainerd, 2, Crosby, 3, Central Minnesota. And there's a reason for that, members, and I know you're, Mr. Chair, you're under timeline, so I won't go into a lot of the information that I was going to talk about today, but members, I really hope and encourage you to look at that, because as we're talking about veterans nursing homes here, and I know there's going to be another one with Representative Koenig right after me, and I know that there's one in Bemidji. I actually think there's a little bit of bonding money in the bonding bill that talks about some design for a northern placement of a veterans nursing home. So, Mr. Chair, we just feel in Brainerd, and we have had a committee working on this for years now, with good people, with our veterans, with our community leadership, with our business people, with you know, every contingency that we can find in the Brainerd area. We have a former Regent Treatment Center up there, a beautiful campus that we feel would be suitable for a veterans nursing home placement. We have a veterans clinic up there. You know, we have a veterans service center at Central Lakes College. We have a lot of veterans services. We have hospitals, we have clinics, we have a lot of services that the report itself indicated, you know, this is why we believe that this veterans nursing home should be placed in that Little Falls, Brainerd, Crosby area. And Mr. Chair, I was going to go into detail about you know, what our vision of the nursing home would look like. You know, homing rooms, feel at home. We want to bring our veterans. We have the highest number of veterans in the state of Minnesota in our area after St. Louis County. And there's a map of the 5 different veterans nursing homes around the state of Minnesota, and the biggest void is in central Minnesota up to north. And so we have a huge, huge number of veterans just waiting to get into the next federal veterans nursing home. This is a 100-bed unit, Mr. Chair, that as I have investigated this, the next veterans nursing home, federal nursing home, which whenever that's going to be, will probably be the last, in my opinion. So it is important that we make sure that this veterans nursing home is placed geographically in an area in the state of Minnesota that can serve the most veterans with the most needs and services that can be provided for them. So, Mr. Chair, hopefully you'll get your information, members, because I spent hours and hours and hours putting that together for you. And so it's good information, and I hope you will review that. Mr. Chair, I won't take any more time. I'll turn it over to former Senator Don Samuelson and Councilor Nesham to talk about their perspective of the Brainerd Veterans Nursing Home, and then also a city resolution we brought down today. So former Senator Don Samuelson, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Welcome, Senator, and please mention your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Don Samuelson from Brainerd, and for the record, I'm not a paid lobbyist. I'm just a volunteer. But we have been working on this project probably for 10 years, and had the legislature taken action about 7 or 8 years ago, we probably wouldn't be here today because I think it would be on the site. Actually, we started out by looking at the regional treatment center. It was a building available that already had been used as a nursing home. It was ideal. But for whatever reasons, the Veterans Administration did not want to use that particular building. They want a new facility. So looking at the grounds out there, it can be easily developed. The infrastructure is already there. City, water, sewer, that whole thing is right there, ready to go. So it does. It just makes a whole lot of sense. We've had volunteer architects, engineers working on this project, putting the plans together, preliminary plans together, and so it'll fit the central Minnesota so very well. And as John already pointed out, that all the statistics have shown, we had this bill before the legislature 4 years ago, and they said then, fine idea, but we want to hear what the veterans have to say about the need and where it will be in the state. And this is the result that came out of it. And so we're here to support the project and ask for your help in getting this accomplished. It's not an easy thing to do. One, I know you're strapped here. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's got to be approved by the feds anyway, somewhere along the line, before Minnesota can go ahead. So it's a long ways to go, but we're still plugging away and hoping that we are eventually successful. But we thank you for your time, and I was going to say, just mention that Ms. Nisham and I left Brainerd about the same time you were closing up your session this morning to get here and beat the traffic, so I know that how that feels. And incidentally, I went through a few of those long sessions myself, and sometimes it's not fun, but sometimes it is. Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate Thank you, Senator. Please identify yourself for the record. Did you wish to testify?
Yes, by all means.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Lucy Nesham. I'm on the Brainerd City Council, and I have been a former employee of the Brainerd Regional Treatment Center, so I know firsthand what a wonderful campus it would be, and that we would have the benefit of experienced employees to take care of our veterans. And I would like to reiterate again what Representative Ward said about the fact that the Brainerd area, Little Falls and Crosby, has absolutely the highest concentration of veterans that are in need of their services. Senator Samuelson reiterated what we have to offer them, and I would just like to say that I don't believe that there would be a better place than the Brainerd campus for our veterans. And I want to thank you for hearing us today, and please strongly consider Brainerd as probably the best area to serve our veterans, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Nesheim. Members of the committee, questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, just as a postscript, I would like to tell you and others that when I came to the legislature, Representative Samuelson was the in charge of the Health and Human Services Committee, and he gave me the inspiration and the basic skills of how to go after something for our area that no one has ever measured in either house. He knew how to do it, and it's so nice to see that now that he is in his retirement years, he's still volunteering to give us some of that expertise.
Any other questions?
Well,
if not,
Chairman,
Representative Wayne. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Representative Kahn was trying to jump in there, and I just wanted to make a brief comment quick and thank Representative Ward for bringing this forward. I know this is something that you're really passionate about, and I know how important this is. Representing part of St. Louis County, we have a huge problem with homeless vets because the closest veterans home is Silver Bay, and a lot of them don't want to be that far away from their friends and family, so they just choose to be homeless instead. So I think that this is really important to make sure that our veterans in greater Minnesota have a place to live. Thanks.
Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to tag in on the Mary Murphy comments. The incredible thing is he doesn't look any different than he looked when I first came here. I don't know how he does that, but...
Everybody else got older, I just kind of... But one other comment I wanted to make,
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, if I may. Forgot to mention that a couple other things that we have going for us on that particular campus. We have a traumatic brain injury program. Vitally important to veterans right now as they come home from the wars. We also have a chemical dependency program right there. So we have a lot of programs that are available to the veterans. And I want to mention that Representative Murphy mentioned, or just Silver Bay. I was very proud to help establish the Silver Bay facility, Fergus Falls facility. I worked hard to make improvements at the Minneapolis campus, which was in dire need in those days. And so I'm very, very strong supporter of the veterans programs, and I'm sure all the people on this committee are as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, Senator Samuelson, Ms. Neesham, have you had contact with the Congressman Peterson, Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, Senator Franken? Any feedback as to the timeline or any thoughts? I mean, it sounds like you've it's 10 years in the making, and you've probably had contacts all the way along. Any inkling of a...
Representative Ward?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Anderson. We have been working with Senator Franken's staff on our whole proposal closely, and ask that same question. What's the timeline? What's the vision? How are we looking here? And, of course, when the Veterans Affairs Department came out with the survey, that was really very, very important and good for our project. And so we can't get a solid answer as far as a federal timeline. Imagine that. And, but they know that we have a solid proposal. And as Senator Samuelson said, and I had my report that I was going to give you this morning, abbreviated, all the services that we are able to provide, and Senator Franken knows that. Every time we get an opportunity, whether it be, Congressman Kravac, Senator Franken, Senator Klobuchar, we pitch, we need another veterans nursing home. Representative Moline makes a great point about the number of homeless vets in our state, and a lot of them in our area. And so we have been in communication with our federal delegation, and have their support. It's just a matter of getting over that hurdle. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I might also, we also handed out just a resolution from the Brainerd City Council, and we have the county support, we have other cities up there support, township support, total support of the whole area in this proposal. So members, I just wanted to make you aware of that as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Ward, and to our testifiers. Representative Ward will make sure that all members of the committee get the material that unfortunately was not available to us this morning. We'll make sure that gets out to everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And,
thank you.
All of our veteran organizations are also on board and involved in this process.
Thank you. We will lay this over. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Next, Representative Conan. Welcome, Representative Conan. I will move House File 17, and we will plan to lay this over for possible inclusion. You may proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and also thank you, Chairman Anderson, for helping to line up this hearing today. We appreciate it from all of you. And also, I'm glad to see everybody was able to get up after the long night last night. I have a number of testifiers that Kate drove in from Montevideo this morning. They left at 4:30 this morning, so they've been up quite a few hours, too, already today. I'll just give a quick overview of this and then turn it over to the people who did the real work here. First of all, I'd like to say this is a regional project. Even though the location of the home is in Montevideo, there's support from, you know, not only within Montevideo and Chippewa County, but the surrounding counties and cities also. And also, the pre-design cost was paid for locally, and now they're also in the process of redoing that because that is several years old now. There's also a commitment to raise $2 million of the state share locally, so that commitment is in place also. Also, a number of the veterans from the area came down, and they're seated over to my right here, and I'm glad they, too, were able to make it today, and I would like to thank all of them for their service, too, and we sure appreciate that. Testifying today will be Mayor Deborah Lee Fader, the County Commissioner Dennis Anderson, City Manager Steve Jones, Community Development Director Nick Hagenmiller, and Council Member Marvin Garvey, and they will introduce themselves as they begin their presentations.
Welcome, Mayor. I just happened to visit your beautiful city here on Sunday.
I hope you had a wonderful time.
We had a wonderful visit celebrating someone's 90th birthday. So
I think I saw you there.
Okay. welcome, Mayor.
Thank you very much, Chairman Lanning, and also to the committee members. My name is Mayor Deborah Lee Fader. I am from Montevideo, Minnesota. And I would like to tell you a little bit about our community because we are also a yellow ribbon community, and we have trademarked Veterans Friendly Community and Veterans Friendly Place. So this isn't just about a veteran's home being brought into Montevideo. We live and breathe this every day of our lives. Our veterans are very important to us. As you know, we do have a delegation of our veterans here. I'd like you to stand, gentlemen, so everyone can see you. And I'd like to give you a round of applause. Thank you for making the trip down. Our goal in Montevideo is to be the veterans-friendly community for Minnesota. And at this time, I'd like to introduce our former Chippewa County Veterans Service Officer and our current County Commissioner, Mr. Dennis Anderson, who will talk about the needs for this home in Montevideo, Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is Dennis Anderson. I'm County Commissioner of Chippewa County, and I was a Veteran Service Officer in Chippewa County from 1995 through 2010, so I put 15 years in that office. I was very honored to serve the veterans during that time for the 15 years, and I think probably once every couple weeks I could see a family coming into my office, and we had, of course, veterans coming in all the time. But once we seen a family coming into our office with the veteran, I just about knew what they were looking for or what they wanted. And I would sit down with these veterans and talk to them a little bit about what they wanted. And of course, that was for long-term care, trying to get into a veteran's home. And I knew at that time I didn't have a lot of good news for them because in the past, I'd called veterans' homes for quite some time and asked them about waiting lists and things like that. And by the way, I have visited all five veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota various times. I was on the American Legion State Rehabilitation Committee, and we would go around to the homes and see what the American Legion could help them with. And the homes are, I know there's been a few problems, but the homes in reality are doing a great, great job. And they're helping our veterans that have some serious problems and making their life a little easier, that's for sure. But anyway, I'd call these homes, and of course there would be a waiting list, and that waiting list was quite long at times, and of course we could not get the veteran in. And I think in most times we talk about how soon it would be, and that's kind of hard for the directors to tell, too. So, but anyway, at the present time, we have over 400,000 vets in the state of Minnesota. And if you do the math on how many beds we have in the five homes, I think we can probably take care of less than 1% of our veterans. And I think that's something that really has to change. But sitting in front of these vets, I don't know if anybody ever has in the committee here, but it's an honor to sit down and talk with the vets, not only the ones that are in the audience today, but the ones I was helping at that time, and doing the things that we can for them for disability benefits and things like that. But in most cases, they would always refer back to long-term care and what we could do for them in later in life. I also had the pleasure at time, too, to talk to a Medal of Honor winner. I've done that. A couple Navy Cross people that have won the Navy Cross, and, of course, a lot of veterans, even in our audience today, have medals of Purple Hearts, Bronze Stars, Silver Stars, things like that. So I think that this is just a condition here that we just must take care of our veterans. And I know that at times that we hear things about post-traumatic stress disorder, which has been in the news quite a bit lately. Traumatic brain injury has been there as well. And there's going to be more and more of this as the wars go on. So hopefully that we can help them with these types of things. And I know dealing with veterans' homes before, the brick-and-mortar part of it is something that the federal government can help with. I know that, and it's not the big thing, but the maintenance dollars through the years, that's the situation right now. And I know it's a lot of money, but I don't know of any place that we could put this money more important than helping our veterans that really need that help, that raised their right arm when they were asked to do. They got drafted in many cases. They didn't have a choice of what they were going to do. And the least we can do is help these veterans later on in their lives and help them being in a nursing home or a long-term care home, a veterans home, to give them the things that they require at that time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mm-hmm. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Steve Jones. I'm the city manager for the city of Montevideo, and thank you for having us here today. I know many of you were up late last night, but actually some of your citizens watched you and stayed up and watched you to the end last night, too. So thank you for your service. I just want to kind of give you a little bit of more background on Montevideo, because we really expect to be a partner with the state and a partner with the federal government. That's not something we're asking anyone to do on their own. And I just want to give you a couple of quick examples of how we believe we can perform and perform with the state and the federal government. About 15 years ago, we joined with the state, the federal government, the county, the school district, to build a new National Guard armory and training center. That's actually connected to our schools. It's used by the schools as space. It's used by the community as a community center. And that's something, again, it's a similar type of project. It's a joint venture by many groups, and we actually took part in that. And then in the year 2002, the city and the county worked together. We actually built one of the newest veterans clinics. And there's now a new veterans clinic in Montevideo. And again, that was built adjacent to our new hospital in Montevideo, and again, built by the city and the county. And then, as it was mentioned earlier, we do actually take a more holistic approach. We do consider ourselves a veterans-friendly community, and we just see the veterans home and the clinic and the training and community center is just each of them a part of this. The one thing that I think we have that is different from any of the other proposals you have in front of you, or will have in front of you, we actually are the maturest, most completed project. I know there's some questions about what will happen next, where is the steps, where can we go. We are actually the only community, if there is another community that's not hiring us, on the federal list. And that's because we have completed our pre-design. And you do have in front of you a copy of our report, which includes pre-design and it includes some other information as well. But the pre-design is something that's required by the federal government to have before you can even get on the federal list. This is something our community paid for. In fact, we intend to update it again this summer. Every 3 years, these pre-designs should be updated. We will do that again this year. So we are actually on the priority list, and my understanding of what would happen, and you certainly need to talk to the VA administration, but really the ball's in the state's court. At this point, if we want to go forward with a veterans home in Minnesota, this one's ready to take the next step. No other one, I believe, is. This one is. Basically, the state has to commit to the construction of the project. And then what will happen is there's points. There's a point system, and that gets further up the point scale. Right now, I don't remember exactly where we're at on the point scale, but again, we're the highest of any project in Minnesota and certainly the highest of any veterans home. I want to tell you a little bit about our project. Again, you have a lot of the information in front of you. We already have 13 acres of land owned for this project. We have an option for an additional 13 acres next to it, which we believe, and Nick here will talk about that a little bit later. We could be some ancillary projects, for example, possibly housing for the workers. The completed pre-design meets the new state and federal standards. It's basically built now as a 90-bed facility, and if you look on page 24 to 27, you kind of have some information there about the design. It's a pod design, so basically what you have is different homes within a home. Not everyone's housed on the same area. It really doesn't have the look and feel of a nursing home on this design. It has much more of an open design. Many of the services, so for example, the cooking, heating and air, a lot of those things are pushed down below. And what you have on the first floor for the veterans is a much more open design. So when you walk in, you may well have the library and the workout area, more something that would look like if you had a community center, more an open design. And then there's different pods where you could put different groups of people. They may be like-minded or have the same sort of disabilities. Or you could have groups where it might be husband and spouses in the same areas. And what happens is there's not one central cafeteria area. Each of those pods are self-sufficient. They have their own little kitchen area. They have their own little living room area. And then they have their bedrooms off to the side of that. And that is a design that the federal government is really looking at for us to do. So when we had this design done, we did work with the federal government on what type of design they thought was important. One of the things that we did do on the site, which we can do, it's very energy efficient. A lot of it's designed to be south-facing so we can pick up the sun. We also, so not only do we have solar, it's meant to be designed as geothermal, so we use geothermal. And also a wind turbine. That's actually a site that can handle a wind turbine. And if you look at the plans there, again, there'll be a wind turbine site on that as well. There's really close community access, and that's something they really want to have now. This is almost exactly adjacent to our middle school and our high school, and that's connected to our training and community center. There's actually a bike path that already runs by this facility. So about two blocks away, you could actually take a wheelchair and go from this home site to a football game. You could actually go all the way to the VA clinic. Now, I don't think many people are going to push a wheelchair the mile and a half to the VA clinic, but someone could. So there's a lot of connectivity with the school, with the community, with what we want to have. And I'll just tell you quickly, you know, cost is the big deal, so I know everyone's concerned about the cost. We're estimating the cost at about $23 million. Of that, the state share would be about $8 million. And again, this could change a little bit, but about $8 million. Our community has pledged $2 million to this project of the state's $8 million. We already have $1.3 million of that raised. Kind of what we're waiting for to get the rest of it is more the state coming on board saying, okay, we're ready to go. But we're very convinced, and we will pledge that, the $2 million. And I think later someone will kind of talk about the partners we have in on that. So again, I think that's the big cost is up front. If the state wants to get going on a project, they have to commit to a project for the federal government to do a buy-in on it. Again, our project is ready to go. It's designed, it's pre-designed, it's on the federal list. If the state wanted to go forward, that would be the next step. So again, we ask you support for this project. We believe ours is a very well thought out, mature project. And then I do want to just turn this over to some others. I know you're very busy today. And just tell you a few other aspects of this as well, if we could.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We need to try and wrap this up. We've got two more bills to take care of, so please be brief, if you would. Identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. My name is Nick Hagenmiller. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Montevideo. Steve used the word holistic, and I think that's really how we're looking to approach this. And we've done a fair amount of ground truthing to basically quantify that to the state level for you decision makers. On page 38, you'll find an economic impact analysis that the city paid for and commissioned by the University of Minnesota. We wanted to find out what this would mean to our local economy. Basic highlights include increasing in our local economy by $11.7 million annually. That's a big deal to a city of 5,500. 200 full-time jobs created to build this home over a 2 or 3 year period, and an additional 200 jobs created ongoing to basically run this facility. And labor income alone to increase by $9.2 million. And, of course, all of you guys are familiar with the multiplier effect. If you do that, it's a huge impact for southwest Minnesota. We also looked at housing. Information on this is found on page 60 to 64. But basically, of course, when you create 200 part-time or temporary jobs and 200 ongoing jobs, it impacts housing. We sought out information from Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, which is a billion-dollar housing development firm out of Slayton, Minnesota. They've agreed to help us at every step of the way, basically providing temporary housing for construction workers and transient workers related to that, and also, after the facility is built, for temporary housing for people to come to our community until they find more permanent housing. And that's what there was discussed with the 13 acres adjacent to this site. Also, we looked at higher education and workforce demands. Information on that is found on pages 66 and 67. But basically what we did, we went to Ridgewater and Minnesota West, the two community and technical schools that are serving our area, and they've agreed to do a few different things. Since 2008, they've actually held free CNA classes in our community at existing nursing homes, and they promised to do that going forward. We want to make sure that there's a quality workforce in place for that. We also sought information from DEED on the existing workforce, and what we found was basically 300 people are ready and able to staff this facility. That's kind of the nuts and bolts of what I had, but I'll turn it over to Marvin Garvey, City Council member.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Marv Garvey, City Council, Montevideo, Minnesota. Just to add on to what the rest have said, we are the home of the 1st Battalion 151st Field Artillery, which was the longest-serving National Guard unit in Iraq, and they also served a second deployment there. In addition, the National Guard Armory is closely located at the proposed site of the Veterans Home, allowing the ability for the residents and the service members to interact. In just the 7th District of the American Legion, which encompasses 73 posts, and in which this home will primarily serve, we have lost 500 veterans in the last 4 years. I fully appreciate your concern for continued operation of the home, but you would be reimbursed about 23% of the cost. Of those 500 veterans who died, you expended funds from other state agencies that you received no reimbursement for. I encourage you to visit the Department of Veterans Affairs website and look at the video they have on the veterans' homes in Minnesota. Our veterans need their home. It is our responsibility to provide for them as they so honorably sacrificed for us. Here they can visit with their counterparts and have something in common to talk about. No one understands their sacrifices while in combat, and only another veteran understands these feelings. I ask that you give this proposal serious consideration, and it would be an honor to the late Senator Gary Kubley, along with Representative Conan, who have devoted much effort to this project to select Montevideo as the next site for a veterans home. God bless America, the state of Minnesota, our veterans, and our service members now serving. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Garvey. Any final comments, Representative Conan?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you're short on time, so if it's the will of the chair, with questions would probably be more important at this point. But.
Okay. Any questions from committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kuhn, or your testifiers, it sounds like you've got a lot of all the right steps in place, and again, I asked the question, as I asked Representative Ward, about contact with the federal officials. And I guess we're kind of in limbo, again, timeline-wise, as far as where they're coming down on this, or have they given you any inkling that 10 years out, maybe, or 5 years out?
Yeah, I think the answer is pretty straightforward from our last presenter for Brainerd, but basically what you have is a 10-step process to get approved. They call it a priority listing. Priority 10 is the bottom of the totem pole. Priority 1 is actively being funded during that fiscal year. Currently, Montevideo is on, I believe, priority level 6. And what that means, it's going to stay at 6, maybe 5, or jump somewhere around in that area. But the second you guys approve at the state level for funding level 1, that'll match up with the federal level. So nothing will happen until the state acts first. But what we've heard, basically at state level or priority level 6 at the federal level, you're looking at construction anywhere between 3 to 5 years out if you were to approve today.
Thank you.
Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to maybe the testifiers, I'm just curious, just as a general background, of the veterans who end up in long-term care, do 100% of them end up in state or federal nursing homes? And I was just, for general knowledge, I'm curious.
No, they do not. That's a great question, by the way. But basically, that's the prerogative. Basically, veterans want to be around other veterans. So currently, I would say the vast majority end up in home health care until they need to go up to the next care level, which would be, of course, a nursing home. At that point, they'd be in a nursing home, and they could so choose to get on a waiting list. I think Commissioner Anderson spoke to the need, but there's a waiting list at all 5 of the facilities currently. So it's actually more of a rarity for you to end up in a nursing, veterans nursing home than not, just because of sheer demand versus supply available.
May I add, Mr. Chair, the ones that do get on there, usually their families are so far removed, they very frequently get down to visit. And that's why the need is so great in our area. I appreciate Brainerd and Little Falls. I'm very familiar with that all the years served in the National Guard. But they're closer to the metro area and other homes than Montevideo is.
See no further questions. Representative Conan, any closing comments?
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for giving us some time. As you can tell, there's been a lot of work done on this project, and Montevideo is very serious about it, and we just appreciate your consideration as we look into the future on what to do for nursing veterans homes in Minnesota. Thank you.
Yeah, the amount of background work and commitment on the part of the community is well documented here, so thank you very much to all of you. We will lay this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
We're going to move now to House File 2766, Representative Ward. And I will move House File 2766. We intend to lay this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I just want to start, Mr. Chair, by thanking you and Representative Bruce Anderson. I came in with this bill late based on a constituent concern that I'm going to share with all members. And both of you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, were very acrimonious to me and very helpful. And I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that. Maybe I used the wrong word. You were very helpful to me. In moving this. I think I used the wrong word, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that correction.
Yeah. I just want to start with that. I just want to start by saying thank you for the help that you provided, and Representative Anderson, you also signed on the bill, and I appreciate it. Mr. Chair, this is a House File 2766, and what this does is sets up a Veteran Survivor Grant Program. It directs the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to provide assistance to an eligible surviving spouse of a veteran, directs that a surviving spouse is eligible for assistance through this grant program if the spouse was married to a veteran who died prior to completing the military forms required to provide for ongoing survival benefits. The Commissioner is authorized to determine the necessary documentation for the application, and there is appropriation. And Mr. Chair, just let me tell you, and Mr. McKellner has been a huge help as well, and I really appreciate it. Let me just tell you quickly the story, and I have the woman's name that was my constituent, Mr. Chair, is Kathy Dosh. And I just want to read a letter from Kathy. She couldn't come today, Mr. Chair, because she's working. But this will tell you the story about what's going on, members. And just bear with me, please. It'll be real quick. It says, Dear committee Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm sorry that I cannot be there in person to testify on behalf of House File 2766, presented by Representative John Ward. My husband, Specialist Gary E. Dosh, served in the military for 26 years and was proud of it when he retired. Gary passed away July 2008, unexpectedly from cardiac arrest on our deck. He had been without oxygen too long and was brain dead. Our two children, ages 18 and 16 at the time, were with him. His death devastated us. I was working. Gary had been sick with some heart, diabetes, GI bleed, and that ended with gangrene. But we survived all of that. I was left with not a clue of where to start with the paperwork, especially with the military stuff. I started the proceedings shortly after his death, but then my son was diagnosed in the beginning of his senior year of high school with end-stage renal failure. He needed a new kidney, so these proceedings kind of took a back burner with my husband's retirement. My son received a new kidney March 1st of 2011. On October 3rd of 2011, unexpectedly, my son died in a matter of 12 hours. Gary was a very trusting person to all. I have no idea why the paperwork wasn't completed. I can only think he thought it was all in order. I don't know. But I would think that after 26 years in the military, he wouldn't just give it away. He had enlisted, re-enlisted after 20 years to have more for retirement to help our children through college. We had sat and talked about how much we would have with his retirement from the state of Minnesota. He was a state employee. And his military in retirement. I feel there should be a follow-up for retirees from human resources to help with all this paperwork. I often wonder, where does this money go that Gary earned, and how many others have gone through what I am now going through? I mean, 26 years of service to our country is a long time. My husband enjoyed his time in the military, but I don't feel he would have re-enlisted. I have the points, letter of retirement, death certificate, and I have sent them all to Representative Ward, just not the signed paper. I have also reached out to our federal delegation for help on this, but this is the first time that anything has moved forward on my behalf. Please pass this bill, not only for myself, but for other widow and widowers, so they don't have to, so all this has not to be brought up again. I appreciate the work of Representative Ward, Paula Thompson, all the members that have currently worked on my behalf in putting this together. Please do the right thing and pass this bill. So, Mr. Chair, that's from Kathy Dosh, whose husband Gary Dosh served for 26 years. And when I received the email from her, obviously, as you heard that as well, you know, my heart went out to her. She lost her husband. She lost her son, both unexpectedly. And so I met with Representative Detmer, I met with a number of folks on military veterans committee, and then I met with Mr. McElnery from the Department of Veteran Affairs, and Mr. Clary with the Revisors and Research Office. And we came up with this proposal, Mr. Chair. And you know, it's an open appropriation. It's a we don't know how many of these kind of situations there are in the state of Minnesota, but we do know this: there's at least one, and that's my constituent. Now, Mr. McKellen and I have talked about this, how many are there, and, you know, he reported to me that he checked with the CVSO, the County Veteran Service Officers, and there would be somewhere between 2 and 7 in the state of Minnesota. Mr. McKellen, when I first talked to him, he said, how could this happen? The military is so regimented, so process oriented, I can't believe this happened, because it's boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom. And I said, well, Mr. McElnery, if it was that way, you and I wouldn't be having this discussion right now, if it worked for everybody. And then we later found out that the law was changed, the federal law was changed in 2001. Prior to that, the retirement paperwork and process was kind of a gray area. And I think that we all agree about that, as we heard from Brad in my office the other day. So in 2001, it was changed, Mr. Chair and members, so that situations like this did not happen again. Because I believe in 2001, there were, you know, some of these that happened, and somebody on the federal level said, you know what, this is just wrong. This is just wrong, where somebody serves our country for 26 years, all of a sudden dies without filling in the paperwork, and then their spouse doesn't have, you know, the benefit that that man or woman earned. Now, I know that there's a survivor benefit package, and you know, you just check, what, you know, all the benefit that you want, and all of that information. It just didn't happen in this case, and I don't know why it didn't happen, but, you know, we're just trying to correct, in my opinion, Mr. Chair, an injustice from somebody that really did a remarkable job in serving his country or her country. I have run some, you know, I do have Gary's potential retirement once he turned 60. He died at 58 years old. He would have received somewhere around $750 to $800 a month in retirement benefits from the military. Kathy would have received, the spouse receives about 55% of that benefit, or around $400 she would have received, you know, had they chosen the spousal benefit package. And, you know, so, Mr. Chair, you know, I had Ms. Roberts put together some potential fiscal information on that, and you know, we can discuss that more as we move forward with the discussion here today. But, Mr. Chair, again, to you, to Representative Anderson, you and members of the committee, thank you for having this dialogue, allowing me to present this today, and at least considering, in my opinion, to correct an injustice to a military personnel that gave so much to our country, like all the veterans do. So, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I will either be up to answer for questions or have Mr. McKelnery give testimony. I really feel bad about the acrimonious term also, Mr. Chair. I just want to, again, correct that and say that you were a huge help.
Hey, we all make mistakes, Representative.
Yeah.
We all say dumb things once in a while, so no problem. Yes, please identify yourself for the record.
And Mr. Chair, I'm Mike McKelnery from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, Legislative Director. And we appreciate Representative Ward bringing this bill forward. It certainly highlights a problem that likely does exist out within the state. However, we have some great concerns with the way the language is structured at this point in time. First of all, as stated, we've contacted some CVSOs, and we've not all CVSOs, and he's correct. We know of two folks that are out there that are under this issue where they didn't fill out an SBP packet, and therefore they may or may not have earned some sort of life insurance policy when their veteran died. Some things that we want to highlight, though, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, our main function is to take care of the veterans. And if a veteran comes with a spouse, that's wonderful. If the veteran doesn't have a spouse, that's equally as fine. But our main function is to take care of the veterans first. Secondly, we don't have in place any sort of process, and it's not highlighted in this bill how we would affect it, to make monthly payments or long-term payments. The assumption at this point is that what this bill would do is make some sort of life insurance payment from a state appropriation on a monthly basis until likely the end of life of the veteran's spouse. And so that's something that would require a lot more research than we have right now and is very concerning to us. Something else, we have within our SSAP programs right now a mechanism to pay a widow if they come forward within a year after the death of a veteran. And again, it's just a stopgap measure in order to fill the gap, because the VA has such a backlog for spouses and a lot of these issues that can be up to 18 months before a spouse is in the system and collecting the SBP benefit after a veteran death. So we exist as a stopgap measure, and that's where we would like to continue to work. You know, as mentioned by Representative Ward, before 2001, in the military, there was not an option on the SBP packet, the Survivor Benefit Program, to choose when you want to have your spouse receive payment. And he highlighted the issue well, where veterans might die before age 60 and therefore not have made a choice on that SBP packet, and therefore no choice is made, no payment is forthcoming. And I'll tell you, before 2001, and I hesitate to try and quote a law that I'm not all that familiar with, but I believe it's part of the Soldier-Sailor Act. One thing that was happening is veterans who did 20 years and retired, if they were married, and they were married to a person for 10 years and then later divorced, there's sort of a default mechanism with the military retirement that 50% of that would go to the spouse. Now, if a veteran was to divorce a wife for whatever reason, marriage separates before they choose to make their SBP choice at age 60, or if they make the choice and they get divorced afterwards, they still have to pay that that insurance plan to their divorced spouse. So it's kind of a protection measure, one way to look at it, up to 2001, where they would wait till they're age 60 to make that choice to protect the veteran in the event of some sort of marital strife in the future. So,
Mr. McElrenny, we need to move on here. Could you please wrap up, and then we have a couple of questions.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The bottom line is we support the effort of Representative Ward and where he's going with this, but this bill would need a lot more work, because at this point in time, if there are several spouses out there in the same situation, we don't know if we'd be required to ask for an appropriation to do a back pay. We look at our Vietnam-era veterans, we look at our World War II veterans, our Korea-era veterans. We don't know how many spouses may be out there that are in this boat, and it could be a significant amount of money if the state is going to start paying or taking up the slack that the DOD and the federal government typically pays for. So we have concerns with that.
So are you saying that there really is no precedent for this, that this would be a new precedent that we would be setting here to address this problem?
As far as we're aware at this point in time, Mr. Chair, yes, we'd be setting a new precedent that the state, and we do lead in many programs relative to veterans, and we're proud of that. However, this would be one of potential exorbitant costs that we wouldn't want to move forward at such a rapid pace without having more facts about the situation.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
it's okay, Representative Erdahl, we'll all make mistakes.
These all blend together, and sometimes I think you're Representative Pepin, but I'm sorry. And I was going to commend Representative Ward for his energy level this morning, which I don't have yet. But I guess just very briefly, I'm glad that you're willing to look at how to remedy this, because, I certainly hope that there is a way to make things retroactive or to do something to go back and make this, if not whole, at least try to do something to aid these people. So a lot of my questions you had already answered, so I'll just make that brief comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
And just let me be clear, Representative Ward, you raise a good point, and Mr. McKelvey talked about it. I'm not interested in going back. I'm interested in going forward and trying to correct the situation from here on in. That's what my vision is, but Mr. McKelvey is right. We need some more work on this, and so thank you for your comment on that. And Mr. Chair, that comes because I remember going to a high-ranking officer and saying, "Help me here. How can I do this?" And the officer said to me, "Well, if I had this problem, if it came to me, I would go to command and say, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to fix this?" So I want to know how we're going to fix this going forward. That's all I'm trying to do.
Representative Leidiger, and then members, we need to at least get a start on the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You actually brought up the point that I was going to bring up about this being an unprecedented program. I don't know of any other state program in the union. It's usually a veteran survival program. It's a federal program that I know of. So this would be, something like this would be, is I think unprecedented, and it comes with an enormous amount of
complexity if we were to go down this road because of the eligibility situation. So, but I do applaud you, Representative Ward, for you know, exposing these kinds of issues. And I think in that example that you had brought up, I know that the members themselves, the veterans, have to actually, they have to do the paperwork, I think, for their spouses, and make sure all that stuff is correct. And it's a shame that something can't be done. But I want to say to Mr. McCallum, one point that you made, and I think is worthy of repeating, and that is kind of the space that you're playing in, which is kind of this, we're there as for a temporary, an immediate gap measure, and it may be that we provide consoling services and burial services and those kinds of things. I think is really what you do right now, and I think that that's the appropriate place for our local statewide initiatives. So that's all I have to say. I think you pretty much brought it up, Chair Lanning. It's really breaking new ground, and we'd have to really do a lot of work on this.
Well, members, it's clear that this needs some more work, but it is an issue that needs some solving. And so thank you, Representative Ward. Representative Anderson, is your committee going to be able to look at this further to...
Well, Mr. Chair, at this time, we're not planned for any other meetings to be held at this time. Okay. The bill came in quite late, and I just thank you for allowing it to be heard. And so I think it'll have to be left over for another time, but we could look at it during the interim.
Yeah. Well, Representative Ward, I think we need to understand that this may require work going into next year to get this matter fully vetted and some kind of solution crafted. So we will lay this over. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Kiffmeyer, sorry to keep you waiting here. I will move House File 2555. And we still have a question of where it may go next. We're going to start the deliberation on this now, and we'll carry this over till tomorrow. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate your taking time to hear the bill. House File 2555, this is the Sunset Advisory Commission bill. That Sunset Advisory Commission was established by the legislature last year. And in their initial meetings, they fulfilled the requirements of the law in reviewing the entities under their purview, and then, as required, making recommendations to you here, the legislature, for your consideration. And, Mr. Chairman, I also have an amendment. If I could maybe ask if you might consider that amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
And what's the amendment?
The A8 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bannion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the A8 amendment.
Okay, Representative Bannion moves the A8 amendment. Do either one of you want to speak to that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to help you with that. This is the first line 1.2 is requested by OET to just have more clarifying language. It's no substantial change to that section. It just clarifies that the surcharges collected are not subject to the section, and that has to do with OET. So at their request, this language is here. And on the next one, the Combat of Sports Commission is being sunsetted and its functions being transferred. And in this amendment, we had started out with a variety of entities, but Chair Gunther has said the Department of Labor and Industry would be glad to have them, and especially in the structure that is in this bill with an advisory council, open meeting law, and requiring them as well, and the authority of the commissioner. So with sunsetting them, we needed to, along the way, we've been talking to the commissioners, but it is at this time Labor and Industry, and Chair Gunther has spoken with the commissioners, I understand it, and they are glad to take that with them. And that is the amendment for the A8, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions on the A8 to get the bill in the shape that the author prefers? If not, all in favor of the A8 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in the recommendations of the Sunset Advisory Commission, we felt it was very important to, first of all, assess the ongoing work of each of these entities and their functions. For the most part, we have the health licensing boards, some under DOH, but the large majority of them independent. So our recommendation is to make sure they all make use of either an administrative services unit or the SMART program. We also dealt with making sure that we comply with current state law, which is that the fees collected should match the operating needs and not more than that in having a surplus. And, Mr. Chairman, there are several other areas as well, such as in the Council on Black Minnesotans, wherever we had an entity that said, in this case, three very serious OLA reports with some very serious negative findings. So what we did with them, instead of sunsetting them next year, that we are delaying their sunset for 2 years. Also a significant amount of work going in to help them to be more efficient and to help them be more effective in their core mission of an advisory council. And they have agreed to that, and that is here as well. So we will be reviewing them again in 2 years when they have an opportunity to be able to. They've had a lot of turmoil, a lot of changeover, significant events. We really felt it was good to give them another 2 years and an opportunity to work with the Department of Administration in their structure and help clean up some of those things. So, Mr. Chairman, I know your time is short. I would be glad to stand for any questions. This is,
Simon.
I think, the fourth committee, so.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to show that we're all repeat players around here and we can be adversaries one day and allies the next, Representative Kiffmeyer, I want to say I really appreciate Section 27 of this bill. And I know we had vigorous discussion in the last committee. This is on page 11. I think it's arguably overdue, and I think this is a great way to address what we think will be a real problem. But just to think about overnight, and I know we had some discussion about this in the last committee, just to think about a possible amendment, you don't have to answer now, but just something to think about. Three things. First, and I think you've had some discussions offline as well, on line 11.20, whether instead of the Board of Medical Practice convening the group, whether there's some other entity. We had talked about that in the last committee, but perhaps, and I know Mr. Nobles is here, the Office of Legislative Auditor could do that work. I know he's willing, probably not today for time reasons, but to at least answer questions about this. So that would be the first thing. The second thing would be whether or not you would be amenable to expanding the scope somewhat of the inquiry to focus not just on the Medical Practice Act, as you say, on 11.21, which I think is good and necessary, but maybe even the board itself. As we talked about in the last committee, there was the big expose recently in the Star Tribune about functioning of the board, and I understand the board has a vigorous response to that, and some of that may make sense. So that's the second issue. And the third issue is, I notice here on page 11 towards the bottom, not all of the membership numbers are specifically enumerated. For example, 11.26 says members of the Board of Medical Practice. I'm not sure how many of that is. Yet on 11.29 we say two senators, two members of the House. In other words, just saying how many of these people. For example, line 11.27 says practicing physicians. We're not sure how many, that sort of thing. So that's just something to think about. I know time is short, but I think this provision is very much needed, and thank you for it.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon. Those are points well made and taken, as you know, this amendment in the language. And I'll be continuing to visit with with Mr. Nobles, the legislative auditor, and be taking. By the way, I was writing down here. I didn't have a pen handy, so should the Board of Medical Practice do that? The number 11.26, and there was another one, Representative Simon.
Well, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Was whether the OLA should be the convener, Whether we should put fixed numbers in the members instead of just categories of people, fixed numbers, and then finally, whether you think it might be worthwhile to consider expanding the scope of this to include not only the Act, which is total is important and necessary, but maybe the board itself. It's just something to think about. Maybe we can have the discussion tomorrow.
And Mr. Chairman, to that point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon. There are ongoing discussions as to exactly that. And as soon as we have some language, Representative Simon, since you have a special interest there, I'll put that on a note to run it by you and help get your input. Thank you.
And as I mentioned, we also overnight need to finally determine just where the bill will go next. Representative Murphy, and then we need to adjourn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm especially interested in the Combative Sports Commission. Are we starting all over from the beginning again then if it goes to Labor and Industry?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, right now the Combative Sports Commission is a standalone but in a dotted line to the Department of Labor and Industry, or in that committee. Chair Gunther is familiar with that. But it would basically be it would be turned into an advisory council. They would no longer be standalone. They would be moved into a direct line underneath the commissioner as a part of that agency. But with it also goes their staff, their funding, their fees, their creating an advisory council so they continue to give input, also the open meeting law, and several other things that structurally, Chair Gunther has said, this will be very, very helpful to have that package of things coming together with them. They are very glad to have that structure with that. So in a lot of ways, the Combative Sports Commission will continue to function, but all their OLA issues and negative findings, very, very serious again, have to be addressed, and the thought is that this will be very helpful to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, will the Commissioner and Department of Labor take it seriously?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I would expect they would take it seriously. I can't speak for the commissioner, but I think they would take all of their duties seriously. But I'm not the commissioner to speak for them, Representative Murphy.
I agree, Murphy. Mr. Chairman. I won't take any more time. But, Ms. Representative Kiffmeyer, I think that wherever it goes, this bill goes, we should have testimony then from the Commissioner of Labor and what they intend to do.
Mr. Chairman, that may help say where it goes.
Members, we're laying this bill over to tomorrow. We'll pick up and wrap up our consideration of it tomorrow. We're also going to get an update from Revenue on the status of tax analytics. We've got the HAVA bill that we need to have further discussion about. Representative McElfatrick's bill 2909, and then that's it for tomorrow. Members, we're adjourned.